today was a special day because they buried Shane McGowan. It's also the feast of Mary, born immaculately without sin, stainless and pure, coming out of heaven like with perfection, so that we can fully absorb the mystery that she passed from heaven to earth and back again to be the Queen of Heaven. It's always been a very special and lovely way to start Christmas, with a feast of Mary. And today it was a very appropriate day to be burying Shane McGowan, who had a great devotion to Mary. And I was watching it on a live stream, it was on Facebook, live stream from Nina. And it was one of the most amazing, beautiful funerals I've ever witnessed. It just had everything. It had a deep sense of spirituality. The music of the choir from Cullay with Padre O'Riordan. The singing of extraordinary musicians, but heartfeltly sung songs by Shane. The prayerfulness of the priest, his exquisite homily, the amazing eulogy after the Eucharist by Victoria, who was Shane's partner. It was a liturgy that made me, my whole emotion, my whole heart was swept away by it. It helped me mourn, not just for Shane McGowan, whom I didn't know, apart from his music, but it helped me kind of, the way that liturgy works, you know, you go to a wedding and you relive your own wedding vows. And the way that the funeral works is that in a way you walk through your own funeral. Because the liturgy is a meditation on the shortness of life and the meaning of death. And this moment had such an amazing clarity about the importance of faith, hope and love, the importance of forgiveness, the importance of the presence of Jesus in your life, the presence of God in your life if you're not attached to the Christian tradition, but to recognize there is nothing but God. And it was like a liturgy that I felt if Colm Kyll had come back from heaven or wherever he is to witness it, he wouldn't find it unfamiliar. You know, a person who was around when the high art within the monastic system in Ireland was creating things like the Book of Kells and astonishingly beautiful chanting music at that time, he wouldn't have felt in a strange world to hear the chanting of the O'Riordan music, the Cullay choir, to hear the kind of prayerfulness about the hero, about the dead bard, the dead musician. There was something about Irish culture at its most spiritual came alive during that funeral. And to hear Victoria in her eloquence really sharing at such an intimate level, like with no censoring what she felt, just sharing reality about Shane's life and Shane's faith. It was so moving, and I felt I have to do something special. So I found a particular meditation that I did one time, and it's in two parts. And in the first part, it's just a meditation on who am I. You know, we all have to make up a story about who we are. We have to say who we are. And we create that narrative and we call it the story of our life. And not only do we kind of write it in hindsight, we live it into the future. So we create, our body is the pen. We write with our life, moment for moment. we are shaping our story that we then look back on. And part of the way we write story, there is choices in it to create what is beautiful, to shape your life beautifully, or to lose your sense of agency and allow bigger negative narratives to impose themselves on you so that your life becomes just a small bit of a bigger negative story. To create your own story, to shape your own story, is so important, I think, for the journey of your soul. And I think that's true no matter what your history or past is, no matter where you came from or who your parents are. My little story, my little meditation here today is just about that. It's just about finding an ancestor and just wondering about her and wondering about the connectivity between me and her, a great-grandmother, and also wondering about how short life is when you think about somebody like a great-grandmother and you're standing beside their grave. So that's one thing I wanted to really share with you. And the other was a sense of what it is for me to pray. And I found a meditation which I did many years ago, 20 years ago, when I was working very hard at Buddhist practice. So I used to get up early in the morning, every morning, and do a meditation. And so the second half of the podcast is a meditation about that experience of waking early in the morning and going to a lonely place, the shed outside the house, and spending time there in meditation. And I hope I'm able to share the two things with you in a balance. I just let one flow into the other for this podcast. So I meditate, as I say, on my father and his grandmother. And then at the end of it, I just fall into a kind of a description of what it's like to be me in meditation. Because for me, there is just your story. You create your story as to who you are. You create it. And then secondly, on that journey, there is this kind of oasis, this well that appears every moment that you need it, and it's called prayer. It's called solitude. It's called going to a place on your own and being there and awakening. And the way that awakening happens in that place, ultimately, at the end of the day, it's not just about a single pointed, calm abiding that we call meditation. It's about being receptive in that moment to the voice that you will hear. It's like the silence itself becomes and is the voice of God. So for me, this evening's podcast is just taking two meditations that I wrote 8, 9, 10 years ago, condensing them and using them as one way to just reflect on how amazing it is to be alive and how extraordinary it is to love and to know that you can create your own narrative with the energy of love, about love. You can love somebody. And I just feel that's the only appropriate podcast I could do on this, what I think is an extraordinary day, marking the funeral of Shane McGowan. May he rest in peace. And I'll begin the meditation, if you like, here. I hung up. It was something I had been planning to do for 40 years. As long as I had the little receipt of the grave. It was something I never quite got round to. But in 2014, it was one of those flat empty years when I have to put things into it, I have to make things happen. Little did I know what might result from the visit to the graveyard. Perhaps nothing. Perhaps something wonderful. But it was the beginning of Advent. I had the Christmas carols from the day before still ringing in my ears, and I was in a mood to let the universe unfold. My father was born into this universe in 1903 in the Guinness Buildings in Dublin City. His father, a 20-year-old who had married a 17-year-old girl who worked in a milliner shop on Cuff Street. He had no money and he drank a lot. He was lean and erratic, with a flair for theatre and poetry. The young girl from the hat shop dreamed of a rags-to-riches life, but it didn't happen. She was worn out after two children, living in a tenement, and when she contracted TB, she didn't last long and was dead before she was 21. The young poetic widow brought his two children to Beaver Row in Donnybrook, where his own mother lived, and she, the matriarch of a small dwelling, sheltered her son Samuel, who danced and played music, her son William, who was now spending more time in the pubs around the quays than he should, and William's two small children. One of the places Samuel and his brother performed, tap dancing and doing various turns, was in the Harp on Harcourt Street, a small club which later became a place of ill repute, named the Four Provinces. It was closed down by the new Free State Police, the Gardaí Síochána, and later reopened as the Television Club in the 1960s, all under the same original licence. This fact gave me a link with my father's childhood, when he would go to plays in the Abbey, the Gaiety and other city theatres, with the erratic poet, the broken-hearted widower, his father. The woman who made the soup for all of them in Beaver Row was Martha Frith, a dark-haired Polish woman, sometimes known as the German Lady, during and after the Great War, with some disdain. The woman with which my story begins and ends. Because I cannot find her. She is a fragment of history and a theme in the oral memory of my father. My father would walk into the city with his father, holding hands, and be amazed at the plays on the stage, and he would sit as a child and listen to Martha, his grandmother, chat in Polish with her sister Anne, who lived and worked as a domestic servant in Galway. Martha was Polish, and her name may have been anglicised from Frid or Frith when she landed in Dublin in the early 1870s. She was most likely Jewish, since there were other Jews who arrived from Poland around that time, and perhaps she was assimilated into the Irish Catholic society of lower middle-class Dublin when she fell in love with William Harding, who was selling calico in a textile wholesale firm in the city when he was a young man. Perhaps the young Dubliner fancied the dark-haired foreign girl, and they married, and her past was obliterated in the name of a good future as the wife of a good Catholic. My father never suggested that she was Jewish. He may not have known. He may never have asked, or he may have known a great deal more than he ever told me. There were blanks in my father's story because he left national school before his 12th year, so he never learned algebra. He sold newspapers on the streets, and he might have ended up spending his life packing boxes in Pimm's of Georgia Street were it not for the Great Depression. The trauma of losing his job at that stage gave him the resolve to return to night school in Rathmines, to study for the leaving certificate, and eventually through correspondence courses with Glasgow University, he reached the dizzy heights of qualifying as a chartered accountant, abandoning his aged granny in Donnybrook to work in Clare, and eventually to Cavan, where he became county accountant with the local authority. It was a long way from the poverty of his youth, and he always kept his origins a secret in the social circles he mixed in. So if his grandmother was Polish, he certainly wasn't going to shout it around the golf club in Cavan in 1950, when to be considered even remotely of Jewish origin wasn't going to further your career or social life in the Catholic Ireland of the time. Despite the Holocaust, which probably had not impinged on the small town of Cavan in the 50s, Catholics were still praying on Good Friday that Jews would be spared the wrath of God for the heinous crime of killing the Christ. So I suppose he was wise even to keep his Polish granny a secret, and his impoverished childhood, not to mention her religion. My father gave me a sense of uncertainty about the world, and a sense of how story is sometimes the only thing that holds us together. Because he married late in life and didn't have a vocabulary of intimacy with children, he gave us little in that regard. And he came out of a fog, a blur of oral memories, without land or houses, or even the ordinary heirlooms that an individual carries with them through life as mementos of their past, such as photographs of parents, relations, images of places they went as children, or even a few silver dishes. My father came with nothing except an old suitcase, a safety box of precious documents, and a story that he never wanted told, and which could not be verified anyway, since all the data that might have traced his lineage back to Bialystok or some other remote corner of Poland had been obliterated by great historical events during the burning of the customs house in the Irish Civil War, where so many records perished, and by Marta Fritz's decision to sign the Catholic Registrar as Roman Catholic in 1876. But my father almost by accident did give me a sense that story was a crucial way of understanding ourselves and of negotiating our way through life. Storytelling was the fundamental way to name the world. And he gave me a curiosity to always seek the story that is already written before it is written. To preserve the story not just as a factual record of events in history, but as a compass with which to navigate the future. And I remember him often sitting in the drawing room beneath the standard lamp with his newspaper on his lap and his little transistor radio on the floor, with tears in his eyes as he recounted small memories of that house in Beaver Row with its one cooking pot and one room and one great matriarch who had been his only mother. Martha's sister Anna would come to Dublin once a year in the springtime, and the two women would joke about how in Galway Anna was forced to learn a third language after her native Polish and her English. She was obliged to learn Irish, she told her sister, in order to be able to call the men in from the farmyard to their dinner. Gawile, she would cry to call the native Irish-speaking men to their soup. And now my father would repeat these words, Gawile, he remembered it, exactly as she said it, Gawile, imitating her, remembering her in that theatrical act as she might have been long ago in Connemara. But the story troubled me, because there was very few big houses in Connemara where Irish was spoken. And in the little thatched cottages of that rugged coastline, I could not imagine anyone having a Polish servant girl. I said this one night to Harry Melody, a publican in Skehana in East Galway in 1991, because Martha always haunted me and I often talked about her to strangers for no particular reason. Harry said that it was probably East Galway where she worked. All around here, he said, there were many big houses owned by people like the Jemisons and the Bewleys, and they all had big farmyards that were like factories employing many dozens of farm labourers. Ah, yes, I agreed, but there was no Irish being spoken at that time in East Galway. Of course not, he said, but the farm labourers were all from Connemara. The hiring fair of Athenry was one of the biggest in the country at the time, and all the labourers hired would have been from Connemara. And so the story might be true. That's what fascinated me. Not that it was a fact of history, but that it was a narrative that might or might not be true. Like the possibility that Martha was Jewish, a young girl on a boat to London and thence to Dublin all those years ago. Like the possibility of God, that it might or might not be true, and that it all depended on what you did with the story. The fact or absence of facts about my father and his heritage shaped me as a storyteller, and it also shaped me as a person afflicted with faith. I was never intimate with my father. We shared stories. I was a good listener, or at least he told the stories and I listened carefully. He kissed me formally each night as I went to bed with his bristly chin. But there was no shared laughter. He remained in mysterious isolation, even from my mother, so that all her life she was condemned to weep and sing alone, though for outward show she was a perfect host. And all my life I've been waiting for the universe to reveal to me something personal or private about him. But it never has happened. He died in 1976, and it wasn't until my mother's death in 2012 that I discovered his box of papers. W.H., William Harding, my grandfather's initials were etched on the lid of a black wooden box with enamel decorations on the sides. Inside I discovered receipts for two burials in a Church of Ireland burial ground in Dublin. The names on the receipts were for Anna and Martha Freed. The location of the grave was on the receipts. It was as if he could not quite erase their story. In all the facades he maintained in small-town Catholic Ireland, he preserved one thing: the location of Martha's grave, as if it was something very special. And when I lifted up the box, I found beneath the papers a silver medallion. A silver circle with the Star of David in the centre, and in the star was written the name of God in tiny, delicate Hebrew letters. I phoned the parish office of the church in question and asked them would it be possible to visit the grave. A woman said she would check with the sexton and that they would call me back. A few days later I got a call from the sexton. He confirmed that his ledgers contained the same details of the grave location and the people interred in it. First was William, her husband, then Elizabeth, her daughter, Anna, her sister, and lastly and finally, Martha Freed. So in early December of 2014, I drove to the winding hill where the cemetery is, and parked on the wide footpath near the gates and shook hands with the tall, fragile, elderly gentleman who was waiting for me with the book in his hand. We opened the old gate lock and passed inside, taking a soft grass avenue through ancient graves with small plain stone memorial stones, until we came to a slope where the graves had no headstones and were simply tiny mounds in the earth like a basket of hidden eggs. It was a small and intimate place, undisturbed but for crows on a yew tree and a tiny church just inside the gates. And around us, where we stood there, was nothing but the soft undulation of the grass to indicate that the dead lay sleeping beneath our feet. At the particular plot he stopped and we paused for a moment. "Well, here it is," he said, intoning the numbers and letters in the ledger. "Here it is. This is your grave." I often think it would be great if I could renounce not just the world, but Facebook and television as well, to walk away somewhere and be wise as naked as the moon with no attachment and live in some kind of bliss so that before death you get to some wonderful moment of fulfillment. That's what used to get me up in the morning when I was middle-aged and still fervent for a bit of meditation before dawn. I would take a parting glance at the beloved in the bed and the baby in the cot, and I'd head out like a medieval monk to the back shed to do my meditation. Sometimes I would wake before dawn, before anyone else was up. I would lie there with a sense of gratefulness that I was still alive, and had slept so well and was still so warm and snug in my duvet. Every morning was the same, a kind of eternity in the recurring moment. I visit the bathroom. I wash my teeth and splash hot water on my face without putting on a single light, because the glow from my phone is soft and gently eases me into the day. I take a jug from the shelf and fill it with well water that's kept in a bucket in the back garden. Then I go outside. Sometimes the moon is in its first quarter, sometimes it's full, and sometimes there's no moon at all, just stars. But I always stand for a moment to look at the moon. The well water is my offering. It symbolizes my heart. And I think of the billions of years this universe has been there, waiting in all its emptiness for this moment, waiting for me to come awake and be present to its very authority. And this too makes me feel grateful, just to be here. I feel naked in the timeless universe. And then I head onwards to my studio at the end of the garden. I open the sliding glass door and go inside, taking off my shoes, crossing the floor in stocking feet, and holding the jug of water. I sit on a small cushion. I place the jug on the floor, and I become very still. I feel a rush of gratefulness again for having survived the night, though I know a night will come that I won't survive. I light the candle. I pour the water into 7 small water bowls as an offering from my heart. I take charcoal from a container and hold it over the flame, and then I spread incense on the charcoal. The flame illuminates the walls. I join my hands in front of me. I kneel and prostrate my body in a single movement. I stretch on the floor, feeling grateful for these clean floorboards. shadows dance on the walls. From the window comes the faint light of dawn as it seeps over the far mountain beyond the lake. I am glad for a moment, and then the gladness dies. It dies like a flame going out. I see the glad man falling, and the happy man lose his joy. My heart turns to stone. The room fills with disturbing emotions. All the stuff of yesterday, all the anxieties return. But they are no longer inside me. They are no longer possessing me. They are in the room, all around me, flying in the air. I make a decision not to dance with them. They dance on their own, and I watch them die. Every emotion comes dancing, a line of them, from joy and gladness to anxiety and bitterness and jealousy and despair. They are like demons in the room. I can hear them scream, but I don't move. I just watch. And eventually, they all die. I have destroyed them by simply being still, by simply breathing and remaining aware of my breath. So a good feeling arises in me, a glow of contentment. The candlelight recovers the texture of a Christmas morning. It is gentle and warm and lovely. But I allow that loveliness to dance around the room until it dies. And when all that loveliness is dead, my muscles tense, and the ugly thoughts in my heart, the dregs of my soul, rise and are retched up into the air. There's no end to what is inside me, no end to the bile surfacing in me, and I allow it all without judging any of it. I don't pretend that the feelings of love and attachment are better than the feelings of hate. I acknowledge them all, the black and the white, as part of me. The well water is the offering of my heart, but it also triggers thoughts that distract me. The water makes me think of wine and song, and all the parties of long ago, and the friends gathered at the table, chattering about their success. I start dreaming of beautiful women singing, and old men slurring their words, and young people perfumed and dressed for love. I have begun to doze, to drift into a fog of distractions, so I must begin the whole thing all over again. I breathe, I focus on the breath, I remain still, I observe what arises in my mind. Each time I meditate, I imagine my death that will come eventually like shadows creeping along the wall, and how sorrowful I will be then, crying for all the times I refused to love, and all the chances I lost, and all the long life lived with my breath held and my heart closed. I was alive, and it occurred to me that to be alive is enough, to be here. But then I began thinking about all that clinging to the beloved, and needing her, and waiting for her to come up the stairs, and fussing about her when she is with me, wanting to put more logs on the fire, wanting to go on holidays, to go to Donegal, to have dinner in a fancy restaurant, to feast on wine for just another day, because there must be one more day. But it was all unnecessary, and even waiting for her was unnecessary. And the longing I felt in my stomach when I was waiting for her was not necessary. and all the books I've written and the performances on stage given were not necessary. All that fretting on the wings and then squeezing juices out of my body on stage in a lather of emotion was not necessary. And though I love my partner, I was all caught up in her, needing her, wanting her, loving her. And then there was the matter of my ego, my needs to be a writer, to be famous and to achieve something in the world, all those desires binding me up like ropes. It's a lot of things to be flooding the brain as I travelled the M50 in the left lane looking for the Galway exit. And all the worrying and fretting I did about depression and all the remorse for lives unlived and people unloved and the grief I felt at my mother's death and all the friends who died and the lack of compassion I had for them all. God almighty, not a bit of it was necessary. I took the exit well and slithered around the Spaghetti Junction and then drove the motorway towards Mullingar and onwards to Leitrim. The sleet was turning to snow in spots. I hoped it would because I love snow. I'm attached to snow. I imagined it on the Leitrim hills, white as bone in the moonlight. I was rushing to be home. But all that attachment to home, all that snow, was of no consequence. All that self-absorption, when all there is or was would ever be this moment. I wonder if Martha Frith experienced that moment, this moment. Not that she mattered to me either. I've weaved her story into my own narrative as a focus of mystery. But I wouldn't know if I met her on the street. And my attachment to others began to mean nothing either. My old classmate, John O'Donoghue, for example, who died young, or the great writer Dermot Healy, who died 7 years ago, or my mother or father or anyone else. They were all in their graves. And passing through Newtown Forbes, I was weeping and full of a strange freedom. So emotional that I couldn't see the traffic lights in the village and I nearly knocked over an old lady heading for a spar shop. And further on towards Mohill, people were flashing me because I was forgetting to dim my lights when I faced oncoming traffic. This is how accidents happen, I thought. People get too self-absorbed when they're driving. And when I got home, the sleet had frozen solid and white to the side of the mountain, and the ground was white and the moon was high in the sky. And I felt that this was a special moment and that I should listen to what was being spoken in the silence. I should listen to the voice that was calling me in the silence. I shared these meditations today because it's the 8th of December, the feast of the Immaculate Birth of Mary, the feast of the wonderful Marian feast before Christmas, but it's also the day that they buried Shane McGowan. And I had been watching a live stream feed from the church, watching and listening to the prayers, the love, the music. I had tears in my eyes. I wished I was there. There was something about Shane McGowan who was so beautiful and so alive and so forgiving and so faithful. So it was an amazing funeral. It was like there was so much joy in it as a funeral. You think about the way other cultures used to be amazed how the Irish were joyful in death. And you could see it today when Lisa O'Neill was singing the female part in the great song, you know, the Fairy Tale of New York. And the life and vitality in the audience, in the congregation. And yet every bit of the joy had this sense that it was properly connected with the resurrection of Christ. That in Christ, in Jesus, we have something very special. I just found it so amazing. I thought I would share that reflection with you about my father and about in some way how life is about trying to find your story. And then life is how you live your story. And ultimately, life is what is the story? There's a silence comes after story. And it's a silence where you find there's a voice calling you. So it's almost like you finding out what your story is and you telling your story, living your story, is only one part of a dialogue. The other part is the voice of God that you will hear in the silence. So may Shane rest in peace. And thank you for being here. Bye-bye.